Fightful.com.
The truth about lynching and the Negro in the South. Chapter 2. Lynching during the Civil War and the Carpetbag Rule. It is said that an abolitionist society, by a bribe of $3,000, induced the slave valet of Henry Clay to leave him and go north. The society thought that this large sum would be well spent in producing what would appear to be such a noteworthy example of dissatisfaction with the condition of slavery. Though the Negro accepted the money and left, he soon repented and returned to his master. Thereupon, Clay gave him $3,000, for the Negro had long since spent the bribe, telling him that when he had returned the sum to those who had tried to corrupt him, that he would be restored to his master's service. The money was given back as directed, and Clay then took the Negro back as his valet. Such a case was, no doubt, exceptional. In one way or another, however, the abolitionists produced more or less dissatisfaction among the slaves and were almost wholly responsible for the escape to the North, or something like an average of 2,000 a year. The Negroes did not always find conditions in the North so favourable as they had been led to suppose. As a consequence, it did not infrequently happen that a runaway Negro would become dissatisfied and return of his own free will to his master in the South. During the Civil War, those slaves who for any reason had become dissatisfied with their condition embraced the first opportunity to gather in the wake of the Union Army, mainly, no doubt, to shun work. While this was true, as an exception, the great mass of the slaves remained quietly at work on the plantations. Thus, instead of creating antagonism between the two races, the war served rather to foster and cement a good feeling between them. Indeed, throughout its darkest days, they lived harmoniously side by side. Elizabeth Collins, an English woman who was in South Carolina for the greater part of the war, says, "In regard to the slave population of Charleston, I may say that they appear to be, almost without exception, happy and contented." Indeed, an examination of several southern newspapers and some books of travel revealed but two possible cases of lynching of Negroes in the South during the war. A Mr. Harris Uche, Alabama, was murdered by six of his Negroes, whereupon the citizens of the county, about 90 in number, after consultation, determined upon the immediate execution of the murderers. The other case was in Mississippi. Some Negroes were hung, seemingly, for trying to get on a steamboat in order to escape from slavery. The Liberator mentions two instances of Negroes being lynched in New York in 1863. A Negro in jail at Newburgh on suspicion of rape was taken out by a mob who pounded him almost to death and then hung him on a tree until he was finished. Two were also lynched in the city of New York, one of whom, it seems, was roasted alive. In no place was there any mention of any Negroes being lynched for rape in the South during the war. Indeed, it is often said that during the Civil War, when the white men were nearly all away from home, leaving the white women almost at the mercy of the slaves, no Negro was guilty of a criminal outrage against them. It may be true. Viewed in the light of the sporadic occurrence of the crime under the restraining influence of slavery before the war, and of its quite frequent occurrence sometime after, it is both remarkable and suggestive. It may truly be regarded as evidence, not only of the generally fair treatment, that, according to unprejudiced travellers, they were receiving in slavery, as well as a tribute to their fidelity, but it also makes it obvious that the Negro and the Southern white man might have continued in harmony, mutually advantageous after the war, had both been free from outside influence. Almost immediately after the war, however, the South began to swarm with harebrained preachers and teachers from the North, ostensibly to elevate the Negro. As a rule, though, they served no better purpose than to aid in setting the Negro against his former master, for it seems they cared not what became of the white man, so they secured the salvation of the Negro, entirely ignoring that saying of Scripture which is to the effect that those who fail to serve first their own house or people have denied the faith and are worse than infidels. Such a condition of affairs was promoted by Congress, who, at about the close of the war, established the so-called Freedmen's Bureau, and shortly after passed the Civil Rights Bill, both of which tended to cause friction between the two races. However, as compared with that of a few years later, the trouble does not appear to have been very serious, notwithstanding exaggerated accounts which were reported to Northern papers. In most parts of the South, and at most times, for something like 2 years after the war, there was comparative quiet and safety. The crimes of the Negroes during these years were for the most part of a trifling kind, petty thievery and robbery. However, it is true they committed crimes of a very serious nature also. Notwithstanding, the law was generally allowed to have its way. Harriet Martineau observes in one of her books that nothing struck her more than the patience of the slave owners of the South with their slaves. Even during the first years after the war, a patient and even indulgent spirit was often manifested by the leading whites towards the Negroes as to their shortcomings, and sometimes it extended to their serious crimes. For instance, in 1866, near Rome, Georgia, a whole family, consisting of a man, wife, and two daughters, were murdered, and one of the women ravished. The newspaper account ends with this: "It was difficult to restrain the people from inflicting summary punishment upon them." For such a crime now, a Negro would likely be burned alive. The same paper quotes the following from the Rally Progress: "Charles Weathers, the rascally Negro who attempted to commit a rape upon a highly respectable young lady of this county some weeks ago, was placed in the stocks this morning, for the last time, having completed his sit-still in the burning sun for 2 hours during each day of this week. He was returned to jail, and will remain in the custody of the sheriff till the workhouse is ready, in which institution he will labour at $5 per month until the fine, $200, and the cost of the trial have been liquidated by muscle." Would it now be possible for anyone to take such a tolerant, if not even good-natured, view of such an affair? In order to make a comparison, I have selected for study here 2 3-year periods. First, 1866, 1867, and 1868, including the year before and year after the passing of the Reconstruction Act of 67 for the South. Second, 1873, 1874, and 1875, when the carpetbag rule, which resulted from the Reconstruction policy of Congress, was in full operation. Although the number of lynchings during the first and second periods are in striking contrast, even this but faintly indicates the great change from the comparative tranquillity of the first, as illustrated by the newspapers, to the confusion, chaos and crime of the second. In 1866, one Negro was lynched in the South for attempted rape, another was sentenced to death for rape, and one was sentenced to the penitentiary for a like crime. Also, near Smithfield, Ohio, Negroes committed outrages on two girls. In Kentucky, three white men were lynched for murder, and three more were put to death by a band of regulators. No doubt, Kentucky was influenced in such matters by the example of the West. The following occurred in 1867. One Negro lynched in Missouri by Germans for the murder of a German. A Negro given 60 lashes in Delaware for assaulting two white women. Three Negroes legally hanged at Charleston, SC for outrage. In the North, two or more Negro soldiers, deserters, lynched in Kansas for the rape of a white woman. Four white men lynched in Indiana for murder and robbery. 30 men hanged in three Kansas counties by vigilantes during the winter and spring. For 1868, two Negroes who confessed to the horrible murder of a white family in Mississippi were taken from a sheriff by a band of Negroes and burned. One Negro was lynched in Kentucky for rape, and another in Maryland for attempted rape. Two Negroes in jail for murder, lynched in Mississippi after boasting that the Loyal League would prevent their execution, even if convicted. A man lynched in Tennessee after he had confessed to the murder of three men at different times. In North Carolina, over 30 Negro desperados who confessed to several murders and robberies were captured and put in jail. 10 Adams Express robbers were lynched in Indiana, 2 men lynched for murder in Illinois, and 1 for stealing horses in Colorado. In 1873, however, 6 Negroes were lynched in the South for rape, 3 were legally executed for the same crime, 1 condemned to be hung, and 3 awaiting trial. In all, 13 Negroes charged with rape. In Louisiana, 3 Negroes were lynched in the presence of 1,000 people for an atrocious murder. 4 men were also lynched in Louisiana for cattle stealing, and another in the same state for arson. Also, one white man was lynched in Tennessee by 15 Negroes. 2 Negroes were legally hanged for murder, one in Kentucky, the other in Virginia. In the North, one white man was lynched in Ohio for rape. A Negro and a white man were lynched in Nebraska for robbery. Also, a Negro for murder. 2 men were lynched in Montana for murder, and 2 in Kansas for supposed murder. During the year 1874, 11 Negroes and one white man were lynched in the South for rape, while 2 Negroes were legally executed for the crime. In 2 instances, one in Arkansas, the other in Missouri, both Negroes and whites took part in the lynching of Negroes. 3 Negroes were also lynched in the South for murder, and 2 for riot, and 4 Negroes in Tennessee for threatening to kill some whites and to sack and burn a town. In addition, 10 white men were lynched, 4 in Arkansas and 1 in Missouri for horse stealing, the others in the states of the Southwest for scandalous murders. In the North, 2 Negroes were lynched for murder, and 2 Negroes in Pennsylvania, and 1 white man in Kansas for rape. In the North also, 7 white men, 1 Mexican, and 1 Chinaman were lynched for murder, and 1 white man for horse stealing, and another for thievery. In 1875, the last year of the second period, 9 Negroes were lynched in the South for rape, and 4 for attempted rape. Also, one Negro guilty of rape and another who attempted rape escaped. In all, 15 rape cases. One man and two Negroes were lynched for murder. Also, one Negro was legally executed for rape, 11 for murder, and one case, cause not given. In the North, one Negro was lynched, cause not given, and one Negro guilty of rape escaped. Three men also were lynched for murder, one for arson, and one in New York for robbery. By comparing the 2 3-year periods, it will be found that during 66 to 68, there were 7 cases of rape or attempted rape by Negroes in the South. In 3 instances, they were lynched, and in 4, the law was allowed to take its course. While for 73 to 75, 26 Negroes were lynched for rape, and 4 for attempted rape. 6 Negroes were legally executed for rape, 1 was under sentence of death for the crime, 3 were awaiting trial, and 2 had escaped. In all, 42 Negroes in the South were charged with rape during the second period. This was just 6 times as many as for the first period. Further, 10 times the number of Negroes were lynched for rape in the South during 73 to 75 as during 66 to 68, or but 43% of those charged with the crime during the first period, as against 73% for the second. That this wonderful change was due almost wholly to misgovernment at Washington, no one can doubt. Surely history was never obliged to record a more colossal blunder in statesmanship than that of congressional reconstruction. Nor is it likely that any civilized people were ever before called upon to endure a system of misrule and legalized plunder equal to that which such legislation, maybe unwittingly, paved the way for inaugurating at the South. The confusion, turmoil, and strife that it created is only too well known. Not only did it result in a cleavage of the social structure, setting one part against the other, but it also caused as much or more financial damage to the South than the war itself. For instance, 4.5 years of Reconstruction, it is said, cost the state of Louisiana alone over $106 million. While the assessed valuation of property in New Orleans dropped from $147 million to $88.5 million during 8 years of carpet bag rule. It was made easy for political fortune hunters from the North, with little concern for the good of either the whites or the blacks of the South, to gain position and power through cultivating the friendship of the ignorant, credulous, newly enfranchised Negroes. This they assiduously did from the start. At the same time, they left nothing undone which might create and foster among the Negroes a feeling of ill will against and distrust of the southern whites. If their former masters came into power, the Negroes were sometimes told that they would be reduced to slavery. The Negroes' love of display was appealed to by encouraging them to form secret societies, to make public parades and hold celebrations, which tended to create a race consciousness and race solidarity. This, of course, was for the purpose of helping the carpetbaggers in perpetuating their power. If one considers the conditions, what else could be expected but riots and lynchings? If the control of the Negroes in slavery times, with all the advantages to such end embodied in the institution of slavery, had often been one of anxiety to the South, how fearful must have been the conditions now that they were not only free from such control, but enfranchised and taught by their new friends to be self-assertive, even if not sometimes encouraged in acts of violence against the southern white people. it does indeed seem that a great part of the Negroes almost ran wild, for they were free, but did not understand how to use their freedom. So lazy, worthless, robbing, murdering gangs of them went prowling through the South. For it is as natural for the Negro to sit in idleness, or shoot crap, to go on marauding expeditions, or connive at insurrections, as it is for the white man to establish courts, collect libraries, and found schools. Can history prove that the Negro, during his thousands of years of contact with superior races, has ever risen to the dignity of stable and progressive self-government? Even Liberia, with all the help that has been given her, is gradually sinking to the level of the surrounding barbarism. And what of San Domingo? Indeed, everywhere, the tendency of the pure Negro is to fall when the white man's props are removed. To return, if there ever was a time when the best elements in a society were justified in taking the law into their own hands, that time was during carpet-bag rule. The wonder now is that such a people as those of the South should have acted with even the moderation that appears. That some of the carpet-bag governments were absolutely corrupt goes without saying. Get all you can in any way you can seemed to be the idea. Justice was for sale. In some instances, it is said, the criminal elements knew that anyone could commit crime and escape punishment for a money consideration. A few examples may be of interest. A man who was accused of outrageously murdering a woman, although caught and imprisoned, was released, it is said, without even a trial, for $800. Moreover, a Negro who had been sentenced by a court to the penitentiary was released and returned home on the same train as the sheriff who took him there. Indeed, the accusation was made that a certain carpet-bag governor, in order to help the Republican Party, connived at the killing of a number of Negroes in such a way that the blame might fall on the Southern whites. At one place, a court, in passing judgment on a convicted Negro rapist, merely sent him to the penitentiary, which so enraged the people of the community that they took him from jail and hanged him near the place of his crime. In order that one may the better understand the reason for the development of the lynching spirit in the South, the following quotations are given. 1. New Iberia, L.A., September the 13th. The parish of Vermilion for years has been infested with cattle thieves. The people have been unable to obtain redress by process of law, and last month they organized a vigilant committee as a last resort. A large number of thieves and their confederates were given notice to leave within a specified time, but instead of doing so, armed themselves and threatened to destroy the town of Abbeville. The vigilantes pressed them, and they scattered. It is reported that three of the band were hung on Friday. All kinds of vague rumours are afloat concerning the number executed. 2. The right of a robbed people to revolt against robbery. In Edgefield, SC, a few days ago, the country was startled by a resolution adopted at a meeting of the citizens of the county, which declared that parties, black or white, who may be caught in the act of firing any house in this county, shall be dealt with in accordance with the precedents of lynch law, which is a part of the unwritten law of America. Edgefield people present a statement of facts which, while not justifying resort to lynch law, shows a very strong provocation for it. Just before the November election, the most prominent white radical of the county is said to have advised the Negroes to burn the houses of the whites, and that this advice was not lost on them seems to be proved by the fact that 13 citizens were burned out of their homes by incendiaries between the 7th and the 19th of December. The radicals have a large majority, and they have used their power without mercy. No security for persons or property for the Negroes and poorer whites who act with them had a majority on every jury, so that it was impossible to convict one of their number, no matter how plain the evidence. And even if convicted, was promptly pardoned by the infamous executive Moses. To such an extent was this carried that Carpenter, the Republican judge of the circuit, announced that he would not permit the state to be put to the expense of trying criminals who were pardoned as soon as convicted. The citizens assert that lynch law is the only remedy for the evils they endure, and therefore they proclaim it. They may be wrong, but they are more sinned against than sinning. 3. Augusta, GA, August 23rd. Several prominent Negroes connected with the troubles in the counties below have made confessions. Jake Moorman, first lieutenant of a Negro company, testifies on oath that 19 counties were to be embraced in the insurrection. All white men and ugly white women were to be killed. Pretty white women were to be spared, and the land and spoils were to be divided among the Negroes. All who have so far confessed testify to substantially the same as Jake Moorman. However, in some states, for instance, Virginia, Maryland, and Delaware, where the southern whites had control, order was preserved and comparative quiet prevailed, while the lynching of Negroes was sporadic, not only during this early period, but even until the present. Discord and collisions between the two races have been almost unknown. It is doubtful if any greater mistake was made in dealing with the South after the war than in disenfranchising the leading Southern whites and granting the Negroes suffrage. The Negro might have been given the ballot gradually as he proved himself fit for it without any detriment, but considering the race as a whole, it may be putting it too mild. It may be too great a compliment to the Negro, too disparaging to the intelligence of the average white boy, to say that the Negroes, with some exceptions, at that time, were no more fit for the ballot than 7-year-old boys. Nor was it any more reasonable to expect them to act the part of men in using it, or in political affairs, than to expect it from 7-year-old boys. They were, and to a large extent are yet, a race in its childhood. President Lincoln, however, seems to have understood better than anyone else of his party what was for the best interest of both races. That the Negroes, at least for a while, with proper guarantees and restrictions, should be in a position of tutelage or apprenticeship to the whites. Indeed, there is little doubt that he expected the southern states to make some such temporary arrangements. For in a proclamation, December 8, 1863, in reference to the re-establishment of state governments by several states of the farther south, he says, that any provision which may be adopted by such state government in relation to the freed people of such state, which shall recognize and declare their permanent freedom, provide for their education, and which may yet be consistent as a temporary arrangement with their present condition, as a laboring, landless, and homeless class, will not be objected to by the national executive. But unfortunately, for both races in the South, Lincoln was assassinated.
You're listening. It's Radio Aryan at Radio Aryan.